Okay, good afternoon, everyone. If you can please find a seat, we'd like to get today's program started. Welcome to the Global Taiwan Institute. My name is Russell Schell. I'm the executive director here at GTI. GTI is a 501c3 think tank dedicated to Taiwan policy research and programming. Towards that, our mission is to enhance the U.S.-Taiwan relationship by contributing to a more informed public discussion about Taiwan here in the United States and around the world. Towards that end, we undertake several major projects here that include a biweekly publication called the Global Taiwan Brief, public seminar series like the one that you are participating here today, an annual symposium, fellowship opportunities for American researchers as well as Taiwanese researchers to come to the United States or go to Taiwan. And I'm also very pleased to announce that we are going to be undertaking a number of cultural programs throughout the course of this year that will include presentations by indigenous tribe members to cultural days that will include food and musical performances on top of our regular movie nights where we feature films from Taiwan that that covers Taiwanese society and issues that facing this dynamic modern society, as well as book talks by Taiwanese American authors. And so, if you're not already subscribed to receive our updates, please do so on our website at www.globaltaiwan.org. All our programs are available online, and you can be the first to hear about it if you subscribe. So please do. Before I begin today's program, I also want to acknowledge Dr. Robert Lai, who is the chairman of the Global Taiwan Institute, and I want to thank him as well as other board members as well as co-founders for their continued support for this organization, and as well as our advisors, two of whom are also in the room today. They include Garrett VanderWeese as well as Dr. David Tsai, and so and thank you for the guidance that you provide, and also I want to thank our staff here for their continued hard work that make all our programs today, our programs possible. So more than 30 years after lifting martial law in 1987, and technically in 1991 when the temporary provisions against the communist rebellion were repealed, Taiwan has emerged as an established constitutional democracy in the Indo-Asia-Pacific region. Yet the grievances caused during and the scars left by Taiwan's authoritarian past, while it was under martial law, still lingers in the present day as the current government and society try to reconcile history and attain a transitional justice for those who have suffered under that complicated and dark period of the island's history. That period, which began in 1947 with 228, a mass protest that sparked by an incident in which a contraband tobacco seller was viciously beaten by the police, and precipitated an era known as the White Terror, which saw the suppression of democracy, in which thousands were reportedly imprisoned and executed under suspicion and possibly under the guise of spying for the communist government on the other side of the strait. The temporary provisions against the communist rebellion, which was enacted in 1948, suspended the constitution and established martial law, during which civil and political freedoms were severely restricted. In her inauguration speech in May 2014, President Tsai Ing-wen of the Democratic Progressive Party, which was established in 1986 in defiance of the then government's ban on political parties, unveiled plans to establish a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, stating that it would address the historical past in the most sincere, quote, address the historical past in the most sincere and cautious manner. The goal of transitional justice is to pursue true social reconciliation so that all Taiwanese can take to heart the mistakes of that era, end quote. In one of the first acts passed by the Legislative Yuan, Taiwan's parliament, after the DPP government came into power in July 2016, it passed the act governing the handling of ill-gotten properties by political parties and their affiliate organizations, and then established the Ill-Gotten Party Assets Settlement Committee. The committee is an independent government agency responsible for the investigation and the returning of ill-gotten assets of political parties and their affiliated organization during the martial law period in Taiwan. Then in December 2017, the legislative yuan passed a landmark act of on promoting transitional justice, which is in the process now of setting up an independent 9-people transitional justice promotion committee, which is nominated by the premier, subject to legislative review and confirmation, and overseen by the executive yuan. The committee has been entrusted with 4 missions: recover and declassify political archives, remove authoritarian symbols and preserve historical sites where injustices were committed, redress judicial wrongs, reveal historical truth and promote reconciliation, and retrieve ill-gotten party assets. The period covered for the act is from August 15, 1945 to November 6, 1992, which is also when martial law was lifted in Taiwan's outlying islands that it administered of Jingmen and Matsu. Indeed, transitional justice, which in a way uncomfortably forces the people to relive the past in the present, remains unsettled and has contributed to a divided society. According to our lead speaker today, Dr. Lee, these issues are presenting new challenges to the further development of Taiwan's constitutional democracy. Now, to address how the development of transitional justice shapes constitutionalism and democracy in Taiwan, our panel here today will attempt to discuss what transitional justice measures have been undertaken, why some transitional justice measures have failed, and their impact on human rights and democracy in Taiwan. And what are the obstacles and opportunity for transitional justice as Taiwan moves towards democratic consolidation? The Global Taiwan Institute is pleased to present the research finding of its Civil Society and Democracy Visiting Fellow, Dr. Ely Lee, with eminent scholar Dr. Richard Bush of the Brookings Institution serving as the discussant. Dr. Lee's presentation will be followed by comments from Ms. Yi-Chun Lo of the Harvard Law School, who will share some Taiwan youth perspectives on transitional justice. Now, you have their bios. I will not go into too much depth, but just to highlight that Dr. Ely Lee is this position that she is in is partially supported by the Taiwan Foundation for Democracy. Dr. Lee obtained her PhD from the College of Law at National Taiwan University on August 14th. She was awarded the Fulbright Postdoctoral Scholar Award and Postdoctoral Research Abroad Program Scholarship from Taiwan's Ministry of Science and Technology. And she just completed a year-long independent research at Harvard Law School, and we're very pleased to be able to have her come down to Washington, D.C. to further her research and explain to more of a D.C. audience on the a policy audience about the significant research that she's undertaking. Yi-Chun Lo is an SJD candidate at the Harvard Law School, where she's studying comparative constitutional law, jurisprudence, and comparative law. Prior to this, Ms. Lo attended the National Taiwan University and a recipient of the Taiwan TUSA Doctoral Studies Funding and the Taiwan-Germany Exchange Student Scholarship. Last but not least, Dr. Richard Bush is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and holds the Michael H. Armacost Chair and Chen Fu and Cecilia Yan Ku Chair in Taiwan Studies and is the co-director of the Center for East Asian Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution. Now, please, I'll ask Dr. Lee to please come and present on her research findings, and it will be followed by comments by Yi-Chun and then final discussion points with Dr. Bush.
Okay, I really thank you for Russell's very warm introduction and a very long introduction to transitional justice. I also thank you for the Global Taiwan Institute to host my stay here. So can you hear me?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, good. Good. Okay. So I'm Ely Lee. Yes, I'm the visiting fellow here. And actually, I do transitional justice research for many years. Just as Russell say, I got my PhD from the National Taiwan University College of Law. So I just so during that time, I just complete my dissertation there, and I do transitional justice research dissertation, I compared South Korea and Taiwan. And after graduation, I just visited Harvard Law School and to conduct one independent research program, which focuses on transitional justice in East Asia. So I just do comparative study on South Korea, Taiwan, and the Philippines. So the So based upon those previous research, when I stay here, I just continue to work on the transitional justice, especially the recent development of transitional justice in Taiwan. So I think right now, as Russell's introduced, right now, transitional justice, the term, I mean, in Taiwan is so popular, you know, especially from social medias or from the news medias, you can find many news about transitional justice. And here, before I go to discuss the whole performance of the transitional justice in Taiwan, I would like to use some time to discuss the very fundamental issue. The issue is the definition of the transitional justice. Why do I do this? I would say because, as I say, now you can find many people talk about transitional justice. But from my view, many people, especially politicians or medias, they sometimes manipulate this term. So that's why I would like to use this this change to briefly discuss what's transitional justice, what's the meaning. Many scholars or especially many institutions, they will have different definitions to transitional justice. But here I just use the UN's definitions. Why do I choose UN's definitions? I think I have two reasons. The first reason is this definition is widely accepted by the UN institutions and also many international organizations and also many scholars, especially the legal scholars. And also, I think this definition clearly captures the whole function of the transitional justice. So, as the slides show, the UN defines transitional justice as the full range of the judicial and the non-judicial process and the mechanisms that the society would like to adopt it to address the large scale of the past abuse after the collapse of the authoritarian regime and or during the conquest of the from the war to peace. So based upon these definitions, I think we can find four approaches to transitional justice. The first one is the criminal sanction, and which means how do we bring the wrongdoers to justice? I think in order to address the criminal responsibility issues, many national criminal law or international criminal law, especially international criminal law, establish many important principles like individual responsibility principle, and also like a non-application of the statute of the limitation to international crimes, such as crimes against humanity or war crimes or genocides. And based upon those fundamental and independent principles, we also can find many international tribunals, such as the former Yugoslavia's International Criminal Court, or the Rwanda International Criminal Court, and also the establishment of the International Criminal Court. And the second approach here is the truth thinking or the truth investigation. I think, as many people know, victims or their family or the society, they will have a desire to know what really happened in the past. And in order to facilitate the truth investigation, you also can find, as well till now, you can find many countries, they try to establish the one independent truth commission or truth and reconciliation commission to address the truth investigation issues. I think the famous example is the Truth and the Reconciliation Commission of South Africa. And the third approach here is about the how to compensate victims. I think the compensation issues is just doesn't only means money, but also means the victims have the right to seek justice and also have the right to seek the truth. And also you can find, I mean, because I'm a legal scholar, so I will also focus on international human rights law. You can find from many international human rights treaties actually recognize the family and victims and their families and also the society have the right to seek justice and also to seek truth, and also they can request the compensation. And then the final approach here is about the institutional reform. There are many forms of the institutional reforms here, and I would like to mention one example is lustration. I think if you have some knowledge about the how countries in Eastern and Central Europe, how they deal with transitional justice, you can find many countries in that regime, they would like to use the lustration law to deal with the responsibility of the former officials of the communist parties, which means that they usually use this law to block those former members of the communist party from holding positions in the new democratic governments. So I just mentioned the four major approaches to transitional justice and also their representative the mechanisms here. And I think it depends upon, because many countries, they also will, not just for Taiwan, many countries around the world, they also deal with transitional justice. It depends upon each country's condition. Some countries will choose the whole bunch of the mechanisms to deal with transitional justice, but some country will just choose one approach to address the transitional justice. For example, Spain. If you have some knowledge about Spain history, actually the Spain the Spanish government, I mean the new government, just choose the forgotten policy. They just focus on how to compensate the victims. But in South Korea, you can find the new government, I mean, after democratization, the new government choose many mechanisms to address the transitional justice. And then no matter what approaches the countries choose, actually those approaches, they have some purpose. And here I would like to mention two dimensions of the purpose. The first one is a backward-looking dimension, which means when we do transitional justice, I think the many important purpose is to heal the historical wounds and also to facilitate the social reconciliation. And the second dimension is the forward-looking dimension, which means we would like to, through the implementation of transitional justice, the new society, especially a new government, they would like to establish some accountable mechanisms and also help society to restore the confidence in those mechanisms. And also, the society also want to use transitional justice, those mechanisms, to reconstruct or to respect the rule of law and also constitutionalism, and also try to protect the human rights. So, with the definition and also the purpose, the approaches of transitional justice in mind, I will start to discuss the whole development of transitional justice in Taiwan. I think before I to address the, what kind of the mechanisms we have done, we have chosen for transitional justice. I think the first things we should talk a little bit about the past, especially dark past of in Taiwan. I think many of you have some background to Taiwanese history. So, and then you also know Taiwan was ruled by the authoritarian regime for 4 decades. It's a long time. And during this quite long authoritarian period, I think we can find some features from the performance of the authoritarian regime. I think the first features is the ROC constitutions during the authoritarian period was suspected, and also we can find the martial law and also the temporary provisions were adopted to rule over Taiwan. And then the second feature is in order to consolidate the authoritarian regime's power, which is the KMT regime's power. The KMT regime just established a very well-functioned security systems to suppress the political dissidents and any anti-government activities. And also the final features here we can find when people they were arrested, or they usually were sent to the military courts for trial. And so you can find this authoritarian regime, which is means a KMT regime, just use a court martial trials against civilians. So based upon this, the whole is a background, as authoritarian backgrounds, we can find, especially from many researchers, they defined institutional human rights violations actually perpetrated the society during the authoritarian rule. So the very famous examples here is one is the February 28th incident, and the second one is a White Tower. And I would, because interest of time, so I would not go to the detailed parts of the February 28th incident and the White Tower. I just want to emphasize, from the research we can find, those human rights violations actually happen everywhere and to everyone, no matter what gender you are, or no matter what kind of the ethnic groups you belong to, or what kind of the occupation you have. Actually, you probably will become a victim of the human rights violations if you have some anti-government speech or activities. You will arrest or integrate, or you will be trialed by the military corps. So I just mentioned the two examples here, as the February 28th incident and the White Tower. And till now, I would say, unfortunately, we could not find exact number of those human rights violations. I mean, exact number of victims of those human rights violations. So that's a problem. I would say this. I think that this main dispute here when we discuss the transitional justice in Taiwan. So have a little background here. I would like to move on to discuss the performance of the transitional justice in Taiwan since democratic transition in 1987. I think till now, Taiwan has experienced democratization for 3 decades. So it's a long time. So here I just divided this process into 4 periods. And the first period is under the leadership of the former president of Li Denghui. When Li Denghui became a president, actually the society began to ask his administration to address the transitional justice. So to respond those requests, so finally, I mean, you can finally we can find the Li administrations mainly focus on 2 areas of the transitional justice issues. The first one is the truth seeking. The second one is the victims' compensation. So regarding the truth seeking here, in 1995, the executive yuan at that time just created one commission to investigate the history of the February 28th. And also, the commission just issues 1 report, try to address the political settings of the February 28th, and also try to explain why the violation will happen there. From this report, hasn't addressed any responsibility issues of the February 28th here. And the second area is about the victims' compensations, which means the government for the first time. I mean, in early 1990s, our legislative yuan, also the former president Li Denghui, met the apology, official apology for the victims of February 28th, respectively. And also, the Li's administrations met several legislations, I mean compensation legislations, to the victims of the February 28th incident and also the White Terror period, the victims of White Terror periods. So, but during this period, I would say one regrettable development is the passage of the National Security Law. This law was passed by the first term of the legislative yuan in 1989 after the lifting of the martial law. And Article 9 of the list of the National Security Law doesn't allow the civilians to appeal to the ordinary court. Those civilians actually they were tried or prosecuted by the military courts during the White Terror period. But unfortunately, Article 9 of the National Security Law prohibit those of civilians to bring their case to the ordinary court system. And of course, this dispute finally went to our constitutional court. And our constitutional court, in one quite famous decision, which is the interpretation number 272, just affirm the constitutionality of this law, which means it just prohibit the appeals for the civilians prosecuted by the military courts under the martial law. So this first period of the transitional justice, and the second period It starts from the starts from 2000. Especially when DPP, it's the first time I would say Taiwan is a it's the first time for Taiwan to experience the peaceful power transfer. Actually, if you look at this this period, the second period from the 2000 to from 2000 to 2008, you can find the DPP government. I mean, under led by the president of Chen Shui-bian, they met many much efforts to address the transition of justice. As my slide shows, they adopted some mechanisms in four areas. The first area is about it true thinking, and also about the victims' compensation, and they also try to address the criminal responsibility issues and also institutional reform. But unfortunately, I mean, the except the victims' compensations mechanisms, other measures of the of transitional justice, I think most of them they just failed, or they just they cannot function because of the protest from the KMT party, and because during this time the KMT party still is a major party at the Legislative Yuan. So many international transitional justice legislations were blocked or dismissed by the Legislative Yuan. So it's the second period of transitional justice. Sorry. So the third period just starts from when President Ma Ying-jeou, I mean KMT, won the presidential election again in 2008. So Taiwan is the second time to experience the party rotation. But unfortunately, Ma Ying-jeou, under the leadership of the former president Ma Ying-jeou, his administration haven't done much progress on transitional justice issues. And you can find many transitional justice measures actually were suspended or changed under the leadership of the former president Ma Ying-jeou. And so I think his for President Ma or for his administration, they choose apology as a main strategy to address the transitional justice. So it's a kind of a recession, I mean transit for transitional justice. Okay. So it's the third period. And this the final period is it's a current government. It's just since 2016 when the current president Tsai Ing-wen just came to power, her administrations just choose new transitional justice measures to address the transitional justice issues. Her administrations actually mainly focus on the institutional reforms areas. So for example, the president Tsai Ing-wen just met the former apologies for the indigenous people. And also, one commission was established under the presidential hall to try to address the land allocations for the indigenous peoples. And also, in 2016. Our Legislative Yuan just passed a law try to address the illegal garden party access of KMT. So the law just passed, and also one independent commission also was created under the executive yuan. So you can find till now this commissions actually has dealt many cases about the illegal garden party asset of KMT, and you can find many news about this. And the most remarkable progress of the transitional justice under the leadership of the President Tsai Ing-wen is as Russell introduced, is the passage of the act on the promoting transitional justice in December last December. And I think as Russell's introduced, the law just provides four main powers to this commission. So this commission can do recover and classify the political archives, and to remove and the authoritarian symbols, and to correct the judicial wrongs, and promote social reconciliation. And I would say, compared to the previous transitional justice measures, I would say the most significant breakthrough to transitional justice is this commission has a power to correct the wrongful decision, wrongful trial decisions made by the military courts during the martial law periods. So I would say this part is the most important part if you want to observe the performance of this commission. So I would like to use this table to summarize the whole performance of the transitional justice in Taiwan. From the brief discussion of the four periods on transitional justice, you can find till now Taiwan under different administrations, you can find actually Taiwan made much progress on victims' compensations areas. And compared to victims' compensation, Taiwan haven't addressed well to the criminal responsibility issues. Although I would say Chen Shui-bian, during the Chen Shui-bian administration era, you can find President Chen or his administration try to address these issues. But unfortunately, especially some legislative proposal of, I would say, legal proposals, unfortunately were blocked by the legislative yuan. Because at that time, the majority seats were held by the KMT party. So, till now, Taiwan made much progress on victims' compensations. Also, Taiwan tried to address the truth sinking issues. And compared to victims' compensations, truth sinking, the progress for truth sinking is very minimal. It's not very much because, as I say earlier, we still now, the government hasn't issued any official report to tell us the numbers of the victims and the whole, especially during the White Terror era period, we still don't know the exact number of the victims. And we still don't know who should bear responsibility for the wrongful trial decisions, or to bear responsibility to the wrongful arrest. we still don't know. So this part, I would say, this part is especially for the current government, because right now the current government just us, you know, try. I think the new administration will start functions in maybe in 1 month. So I think of the for new commissions, I think they should spend much resources and, you know, to try to work on these areas. I mean, choose thinking areas. And also regarding the institutional reform, this area, I think the current government, I mean, the President Tsai Ing-wen, as my previous introduction, you can find her administrations till now not much progress and efforts on the institutional reforms. But still, those reforms face or encountered much challenges from the society or from the opposition party, I mean the KMT parties. So I would say, based upon those discussions, I would like to briefly address what kind of factors shape the transitional justice in Taiwan, and also what kind of the difficulty we face here. I think regarding the factors, we can find, I think here we can find two main factors. The two main factors to shape the very weak performance of transitional justice in Taiwan. The first factor here is the negotiate transition in Taiwan. I think the transition in Taiwan is quite peaceful, but to some extent, this type of transition just sacrificed the transitional justice, especially at the beginning of the democratizations. So it's very difficult. I mean, at the beginning of the democratization, you also can find, because the KMT regime still dominates much political resources. So because of those conditions, so it's very difficult to launch truth investigation and also to implement launch the criminal trials to the wrongdoers. And so you can find, so two factors can explain why the transitional justice in Taiwan, you know, is quite weak. I mean, it means that you just only can find the victims' compensations or the minimal truth thinkings to the perform of the transitional justice. And so so this part is about the factors. And then the second part is about the difficulties. What kind of difficulty when we adjust the transitional justice here? I think I just divided the difficulties into two parts. The first part is the legal constraints, and the second part is the non-legal difficulties here. And then I would say the legal obstacles here is about especially when we would like to address the criminal responsibility issues. I think because those human rights violations, I mean, during the authoritarian period, they just happened many, many years ago. So because of the passage of the time, so it's very difficult to address the criminal responsibility issue, which means it's very difficult to launch the criminal trials against the wrongdoers. And so if we really want to, I mean, legally speaking, if we really want to address the criminal responsibility issue because of the passage of time, so we need to deal with the issue about the statute of the limitation. Because in the old, I think if you have some legal knowledge, you will know usually the ordinary criminal law will pose some limitations on crimes prosecution. So So how to deal with statute of the limitation? I always say here we either revise the ordinary criminal law or we should enact the special law to remove the statute of the limitation. Here I can give you some example. I would say in South Korea when they addressed the former president's criminal responsibility in Gwangju incident. So in 1995, the National Assembly of South Korea finally passed the one special law to remove the statute of the limitation. So because of this law, so finally the prosecutors in South Korea, they finally just launched the investigation, criminal investigation and prosecutions against the two former presidents in South Korea. And the second legal issues here is the is about the responsibility of the administrative atrocity during the White Terror period. Here is about, as I say, you know, during the White Terror period, you can find many people, especially civilians, they were arrested and interrogated and also finally tried by the military courts. And so, as I say earlier, who should, finally we can find some, I think most of the decisions, they are met wrongfully. And so, who should bear the legal responsibility for those wrongful trial decisions, and also who should so how to address the responsibility issues here. And as we know, right now the Legislative Yuan just passed the new law for transitional justice. And according to this new law, actually, this new commission has a power to address these issues. So this new law will requires those who met the wrongful trial decisions should compensate the victims, and they should so they should bear some responsibility for those wrongful decisions. And the final difficulties is not a the legal difficulty, it's a non-legal obstacle here. It's about the authoritarian legacy, which means till now, if you observe the transitional justice, the development here, in Taiwan, you still can find not only KMT regime, but also its affiliations. I think they strongly resist the transitional justice. So this authoritarian resistance poses a huge challenges to transitional justice in Taiwan, especially with current development. So I would like to use the example of the National Women's League case. I will not go to the very detailed part, the detailed development of this case, but you can find finally this league, the National Women's League, finally reject to sign the administrative contract with the government. So you can find those, this case shows how powerful of the authoritarian resistance. And also you can find when Women's League, rejects to sign administrative contract, it means the whole cases or disputes finally will went to the court. Will goes to court to seek the remedy. So it just will put the courts, I would say in my view, this case will put the courts, especially the administrative court in Taiwan, put the courts in quite risky position. Because right now, the court need to decide, you know, need to involve in the transitional justice disputes. So how the court deal with these issues? What kind of the strategy the courts will have? I think we can continue to observe this development. And so here, I just mentioned we have some difficulties when we discuss transitional justice. And of course, we can still find some opportunities from this development of transitional justice. Here, I would like to say, because as I say, we have some legal obstacles, and also we can find authoritarian resistance from the opposition party or from their affiliate organizations. I think two solutions can help the development of transitional justice in Taiwan. The first solution is, or opportunity, I would say opportunity, is from our civil society. I think since Taiwan initiated democratization in the late of the 1980s, our civil society grew up very quickly and strongly, I mean, increasingly. So our civil society, also our civic groups, they work actively on transitional justice issues. I can give you some examples. For example, the civil groups, they push the government to pass the compensation legislations. And also, they also request the new government as well to abolish some notorious legislations. I mean, civil groups, they put much their resources and the capacity to challenge the decisions of our governments in dealing with transitional justice. And I would say here I would like to mention one important group in Taiwan. I think in 2007, one group, it's the first time, I think it's the first group to address, I mean, just many will focus on the transitional justice issues. This group, the name is the Taiwan Association for Truth and Reconciliation. So this group work quite actively for transitional justice issues. And so I think the main achievement of this group is they push the government to pass the new law about transitional justice. So they also ask our government to open the archives for the public and also for academic research. So this group, because of this group efforts, we can find some progress with math. This is the first solution, I would say first opportunity for transitional justice in Taiwan. The second one is the recent development of here I would like to address some backgrounds. Since 2009, Taiwan has a very troubled statehood. So Taiwan actually cannot participate many international, especially international activities. So they cannot participate in the UN's organizations. But since 2009, Taiwan voluntarily to ratify several international human rights treaties. So which means Taiwan ratified the ICCPR and the ICESCR, two main human rights treaties. And also our legislative yuan just passed the implementation law, tried to incorporate those human rights treaties into the domestic legal systems. So because of this new development, I would say this new development provides some new opportunity for the transitional justice in Taiwan. What do I mean here? I would say because if you look at the ICCPR, especially ICCPR Article 2, Section 3, this provision requires the government, the state party, should investigate, should compensate, should bring the justice to the victims, especially for the victims of the serious human rights violations. So because of the state obligation, I mean from the international human rights treaties, so it just impose legal obligation for our government, because right now our government, Taiwanese government, just ratify those treaties and also just make the one implementation law for those treaties. So, our government, you know, in order to fulfill the state obligations, our government also in 2013 and also in 2017, they invite the 10 independent human rights experts to Taiwan and to review the state reports of ICCPR and ICESCR. So after they review those state reports, in transitional justice areas, the committee emphasizes and requires our government need to open archives and restore justice for the victims in their concluding remarks and the conclusions. And so I would say such development also actually right now has positive impact. You can find, over here I just give you some example. It's the recent decisions made by our Taipei Administrative Court in 2016. In this decision, I think it's the first time for the court to recognize the victims, especially the foreign victims of the February 28 incident. The victims have the right to compensation. And also it means the victims, the foreign victims, have the right to request the compensations from the February 28 Incident Memorial Foundation. So these decisions demonstrate the incorporations of the international human rights law empower the court to address the transitional justice issues. I think it's very, from my view, this case is the first case that the court boldly use the international treaty, especially human rights treaty, to address the transitional justice. So here I have a very short conclusion. I think right now, as I say, Taiwanese government made much progress on victims' compensation and the minimal of the truth thinking. Still, they still cannot address well to the criminal responsibility issues and also the institutional reforms issues. So I would say transitional justice is a long, long road, and it needs many efforts from society, from the domestic society. Also we need to some help from the international society. So here I would like to say I think Taiwan, if you, especially for current government, if we want to make a huge breakthrough on transitional justice, I think the first thing is we should obey the legal obligation from international human rights treaties. And the second one is, I would say, our civil society, especially our civic groups, I think they should continue to watch the performance of our government on transitional justice. And also, I think each social member, I mean the member of the society, they should continue to work on or to watch and also watch the performance of the government on transitional justice. So that's my brief conclusion here. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that very comprehensive methodological presentation. It was very substantive, and I think it was great that you went into the specific legal elements of transitional justice and how different administrations in Taiwan have approached this issue and where there have been shortcomings in others, and now, you know, to this point now, how that sort of progressed. And so I think it's very instructive. And so next, I want to welcome Isha to make her presentation, comments on the, you know, on youth perspectives on transitional justice. Please.
Good afternoon. So it's a great pleasure and honor for me to be here to listen to Ili and to be part of the conversation. So I'm here to share my thoughts on the younger generation's involvement in transitional justice. So I'm a lawyer by training, but I'm here to more talk about some aspect in this transitional justice movement. So picking up from what we left, what she ended and concluded, so we see the international aspect and so the foreign aspects in transitional justice, right? So we see the UN's role in pushing domestic governments to work or respond to international standards, and also NGOs' role, and surprisingly, actually foreign practices like South Africa or South Korea, especially Germany's practice to address transitional justice, have huge impact on Taiwanese imagination of how transitional justice should be conducted. So experts hope that this international pressure can one day be turned or be changed into domestic implementation. And I think it is from this aspect we hope to see how this changing dynamic in domestic politics can involve the youth generation. In other words, we see the youth generation get involved of how the government welcome or invite the youth generation to be part of this dialogue is something very interesting to observe. So a little bit more about myself. So last year, as Russell mentioned, 2017 was the 30th anniversary for Taiwan to lift martial law. And I was born in the same year as DPP, that was 1 year earlier than that. So actually in my memory, I didn't remember Jiang Jingguo died. Some of my elder friends told me they remember Jiang Jingguo died and their cartoon turned into black and white. That's their only memory. So we grew up in an environment where election is the normal politics, right? So Huang Dazhou ran for mayor and Chen Shui-bian won, and then he ran for president. And so party politics elections are very normal to me. But the wake-up call for me was in 2004. It was the time when Chen Shui-bian won the second campaign for the president, and supporters from Lian Zhan and Song Zhuyu, so they protested in front of the presidential office, and my high school happened to be the building right next to the presidential office. So I observed a lot, and I was just disturbed by the noises. So, but out of that, I just want to say, so that was really the first time I experienced a divided classroom. I noticed my friends and I have very different opinions about what the protest was about, and it was also the first time I became aware that there was a politicized lecturing from one of my social sciences teacher, who studied the three principles of the people from Sun Wen when she was in college, and she lectured on that subject for many years, just until the year before 2004, when that subject was removed from the required curriculum. So I actually want to address the issue of curriculum from the Education Bureau in Taiwan. So I was one of the first pupils who used the reform textbook Understanding Taiwan. This is Taiwan. And so there are three parts of in this curriculum, geography, social sciences, and history. And what was significant about this Understanding Taiwan series was that it was the first time Taiwan knowledge was made into textbooks. And we had a whole semester teaching our pupils how to know more about your cities and this island. And it was over a semester. And so many people argue that it was the most significant step for the DPP to change or brainwash the pupils. And it was so efficient that after Ma Ying-jeou became the president, he was very aware that this is something need to be changed. So they had a series of different reforms, and the first thing they did was to change the curriculum. So they asked you can say it's more like a Chinese centric more than China centric. So they put emphasis on the Han people's immigration to this island, and they labeled Japan as colonizers repeatedly, and they put the term retro secession back in the textbook. So they are very contentious. So each of them are very contentious ideas, and they should be open to different interpretations. And we see that the curriculum has become the battlefield for people from very different identities. And in 2014, this finally evoked fierce protestations from very different camps. So for the defenders of this new curriculum, they think it's a return to the framework from the constitution. So what it means is that it's a ROC constitution. So what can be wrong with ROC? But for its opponents, this rhetoric covers up the complexity involved in interpreting the historical facts in Taiwanese history, and this final result that many high school students went on strike and they protest, and it's still until today an open question how to select a neutral term to address Taiwanese history, and are there neutral terms at all to address these issues, and can there be a united curriculum for obligatory education at all? And I think these are very very hot topics in the U.S. as well, as we can see the racial division, etc. But these are exactly what's happening here back in Taiwan as well. And the second thing I want to address is the new wave of political parties. So the new political parties I refer here is the New Power Front, Sidai Liliang, and Social Democratic Party, Shenmingdao. But to say that the new generation became supportive of this new political party really underestimate what they did, because these political parties actually seized the momentum that were partly created by the new generation when they initiated or when they mobilized the Sunflower Movement. So from some aspect, you can say that these political parties are institutionalized body of what this new generation, what they believed. And for many people, they are attractive because it seems to go beyond this blue-green division, and they focus more on social policy issues, and they dare to touch upon some very sensitive issues like gay marriage, or they go for the workers' rights more boldly. So for some people, it really go along with what they believe, their ideals for the society. And I'm happy to see that these social policy issues, which were more like concealed or underwatered under the previous political talks or those hot air, these were more concealed, but until now we see the these discussions formed by the new parties really shape the landscape, the political landscape, according to different ideologies, which were more concealed from the identity problem like 20 years ago. So Jimenez, so conclusion, and so I think from this new generation's perspective towards the transitional justice, it's a really a fight between amnesia and innovation. So the largest enemy for transitional justice is not the authoritative regime, it's time, right? So people forget and people die. So the victims die, so there are no storytellings, then there is no transitional justice. So justice is a big word, but it's actually a dynamical movement from time to time. And but it is also interesting, so Ely mentioned the Spanish example. It's famous for its forgetfulness. People chose to forget what happened, but it changed. So in 2007, also from the Spanish young generation, they forced the government to enact a new law, the historical memory law, and it forces the government to touch upon, if not retouch upon, of what happened, and they want the name list of what happened to their grandparents' generation, who are the victims and who should be responsible. So it was like 30 years or many decades after Franco died, and this was a delayed justice, and that is also what we are seeing in Taiwan. It's a delayed justice, but that's partially because we are waiting for some conditions to be met, so that we have the momentum and the forces to further the efforts.
Thank you very much, Ethan. I think that's made a very interesting observation, you know, about how actually majority of the youth now between the age of 20 and 39 have not lived through martial law, have not experienced, you know, and experienced perhaps very, very vaguely the tail end of when it was really actually liberalizing. And so they have a very different perspective as to what is sort of justice in terms of this in this seeking for transitional justice in Taiwan. Richard, please, could you perhaps offer your perspectives and on the presentation and any insights you may be able to add from a U.S. perspective on this issue?
Thank you very much, Russell. And thanks to Ely and Yichun for your remarks. I think, Ely, you gave a very good inventory of the different forms of transitional justice and the obstacles in Taiwan to making advances on all of them. I think for reasons of time, and because we have some really smart people in the audience, I'm going to abbreviate my remarks a little bit. I want to address four questions briefly. First, why me? Second, what's the meaning of justice? Third, who cares? And four, who benefits? Now, on the why me question, some might ask whether any American, including myself, has any right to speak about transitional justice anywhere, including Taiwan. After all, in my view, the United States has not done a very good job itself on issues of transitional justice. You might even say we've done a terrible job. But Russell invited me, so that's all the authority I need to speak. So, what does justice mean? Dr. Lee made very clear that there are very different ways of rendering transitional justice, some more, some less controversial than others. When you get to the controversial forms, particularly holding perpetrators to account, this raises some basic questions. And in thinking about justice, there's a long-standing distinction between procedural justice and substantive justice. Procedural justice exists because of how a decision is rendered, whether it reflects a due process of law. Substantive justice occurs when the plaintiff, the victim, community, or the whole society believes that it is morally correct. Now, we all understand that the victims of the white terror and martial law receive neither procedural justice nor substantive justice. That's a given. They were treated horribly. The question going forward, in thinking about how to rectify the abuses of the past, is how to maximize both procedural and substantive justice. These can conflict with each other. Dr. Lee's already mentioned issues such as statute of limitations. There's also standards of proof, rules of evidence, the role of witnesses, etc. What should we strive for, I think, is a balance between the two, so that any decision that might be made is seen as both procedurally just and substantively just. Now, turning to the question, who cares? And I admit that what I'm about to present is quite puzzling to me. The issue is the breadth of popular support for the Transitional Justice Project in Taiwan. Clearly, there's some people who care very deeply about this, and they have their reasons for doing so. On the other hand, it's not clear that the public at large feels so strongly. The late 2017 TED survey, Taiwan Election and Democratization Survey, it found that only 2.6% of those polled said that transitional justice was the highest priority issue that President Tsai should address. Only 3.5% thought it was the second highest priority. There's small variations in responses according to age and education, but the bottom line is that less than 6% of the population thinks that this is a high priority, if these polls are correct. And so it's a puzzlement. This may be a situation where a very active minority is pushing the issue of transitional justice, but the broad majority doesn't care, and that's often the how democracies operate. It's active minorities pushing sort of majorities that don't care either way. But this sort of suggests that we need to look at transitional justice in Taiwan in the larger political context, and that brings me to my question of who benefits. Now, to the extent that this project is successful, certainly the victims of the injustice will benefit, their families will benefit, civil society organizations who promoted this cause will benefit, those parts of the public who care about this issue will benefit. But we've also need to look at the downside costs. And here I point to the polarizing effect that this has had within Taiwan's political system. This is related to the conflict within transitional justice of the goals of accountability and reconciliation. You can push accountability to the point that reconciliation isn't possible and vice versa. Now, we understand why the KMT hates transitional justice. It's financial, it's reputational, and so on. There'll be an impact on KMT perceptions about the DPP and its goals. Polarization and division, to the extent that it exists between the two major parties, could make it harder to take joint action on issues that the public clearly does care about, like the economy, the environment, and so on. I hope that doesn't happen, but if it does, that means that the Taiwan public will suffer. In my view, polarization and division benefits one other actor, and that is China. the greater Taiwan's division, because of anything, the more China benefits, because it is harder for Taiwan to reach consensus on how to confront what is truly an existential challenge. So it would be truly unfortunate if the effort to foster justice about the past handicaps Taiwan as it struggles to address a dangerous future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard, for that. I want, in the interest of time, I have prepared a set of questions, but I really do want to give an opportunity for the audience to ask some questions. So if I want to open it up right now, so please state your name and your affiliation, and wait for the microphone, please. Does anyone have any questions? Garrett? Okay, please.
Thanks very much. Excellent presentation. I'm Garrett Vanderwees. I teach history of Taiwan at George Mason University. And just this week, I'm giving my students the assignment on what is transitional justice in Taiwan.
So now you know the answer.
You'll see next week. A question for Ely. You said in your overview at the end that even now, under the Tsai Ing-wen administration, there are no criminal sanctions against those responsible. Why is that? Because the DPP does have the majority in the legislative yuan. Why has not that happened? Or is that still happening in the future with further judicial reforms that are being taken?
Okay, thank you for your questions. Yes, I think, as I've my presentation shows, I think when, especially for the current government, if people want to address the criminal responsibility issues, they need to deal with some legal obstacles. For example, the statute of the limitations. Oh, okay. So they need to deal with the statute of the limitation. And of course, as you say, the current government right now, they have the host presidency and the majority seats at last yuan. I think for them, they would, okay, now, they of course, they can make the new law or to revise the law to address the statute of limitation. But another question is how is feasible questions? Because right now, I think this question is about the policy. It's a policy issues. If we, just as Richard mentions, if we would like to address the accountability issues, which means we would be, especially for current government, they will encounter the huge challenge or the huge protest from the opposition party. So, and also we can find transitional justice has many goals, not just accountability, but also we want to reach social reconciliations, and then we want to bring to more dialogue. I mean, try to help society to heal the historical roots. So I would say if for the current government, if they put much efforts on accountability issues, to some extent, these actions may impede other dimension of transitional justice. So, which means maybe there, for example, the legal proposals for the truth thinking or for the institutional reforms may also encounter the huge challenges from the opposition parties. So I think it's so that's why I say it's a policy issues. It depends upon how current government, what kind of the goal they want to pursue. If they want to pursue, push up the, because we can find, the resources is limited. I mean, even for transitional justice, the political issue, the resources for current government is limited. So how to, and also if we want to push the transitional justice and move forward, sometimes we need to balance, you know, balance, find a balance between the different goals. So I would say, of course, I would say for victims or for some scholars, they will strongly require the current government to deal with the criminal responsibility issues. But as I say, it's a cost and the benefit issues, and also it's a balance, it's a policy issue. So for current government, you should find a balance between the accountability and also other values, reconciliation and the truth investigations. So, yeah.
Nadia?
Nadia Chow with the Liberty Times. For Dr. Lee, thank you for a very interesting presentation. I noticed you mentioned, you know, even in Taiwan's case, the progress has been very slow, but you also indicate it's quite relatively a peaceful process. Since many people like to compare South Korea and Taiwan, you know, on their accomplishment of democratization and also transitional justice, we also understand the Korean case usually is very radical, right? They maybe made a big progress, but with a big price. So since you made a comparison or studied a comparison, can you tell us, you know, what's the Korean model for Taiwan, something that's valuable? Or do you think they paid a higher price, which, you know, we don't really mention very often? Thank you.
For Taiwan, the Korean case, I think the Korean experience can provide some lesson for Taiwan, especially the true thinking areas. If you look at how Korean government deal with transitional justice, I think the most significant features is the government, I mean Korean government, established many truth commissions to different human rights violations. And I remember one professor from Korea, he explained why the Korean government established so many commissions, especially truth commissions, to investigate the past human rights violations. He say the truth investigation, truth finding, is the first step for the transitional justice. And I think for Taiwan, especially for current government, as I slide show, right now, till now, the government still hasn't issued any report, official report, to tell the society what really happened during the white terror period. Also, some people may have a question about the facts about the February 28th incident. So I would say the Korean case, I think they emphasize the importance of the truth thinking, truth investigation, because if we have enough the truth facts, I think that those truths can facilitate the criminal sanctions. Also, we can use those facts and the truth as evidence, you know, to try to also to deal with the collective memory issues. You know, Taiwanese society is very divided. The part of the reason is the national identity. So how do we construct, build up the collective memory for the society? I think the truth thinking, this job, this work, can provide some resources for help society to build up the collective memory, and also to provide some, I would say the resources or foundations for when we deal with the national identity issues.
Okay. the two questions. I do think that point was excellent, that, you know, that Taiwan needs a new narrative, right? And I think, you know, your point, Ethan, about education being an important part of it, and Richard's about the polarization and the dangers of polarization and how that might influence, you know, Taiwan, you know, speaks to the importance of finding a new narrative, and part of, you know, transitional justice, if properly managed, is being able to find that new narrative that makes a stronger collective memory and a stronger social cohesion in Taiwan. And so without any further questions, please join me in thanking our panelists for their presentations.